Once upon a time, in the paradoxical world of Hindu belief, all there was God. This God wanted to have some fun, so he split himself up into trees and stars, swans and horses, and everything else. He also divided himself into many, many Hindu gods. 2.5 million, as a matter of fact. And into all the other people who would ever live, including you and me and Wendy Doniger.
Raghupati Raghava.
This is Wendy's personal story, her song. It's also a story told by a scholar named Wendy Doniger about gods and kings and mythical beasts who appear and reappear in Hindu tradition across the ages. If the two tales seem to fold together, separate, rejoin, and then go off in their own directions again, don't worry. In India, the commentary comes built right into the narrative. It's okay for the storyteller to be in the story.
I learned that song as a Pete Seeger song long before I knew any Indian language. First Sanskrit I ever learned. I knew it as a sort of a New York Jewish communist song. And then years later I discovered that it was a Gandhi, Untouchables, and Get the British Out of India song. And it was wonderful the way those two worlds came together.
Like two parallel trains that were running in the night and didn't see each other until a kind of dawn, Wendy says in her poetic storyteller's fashion. When Wendy was growing up in the years after World War II, the Doniger living room was a gathering spot for radicals and intellectuals, including Pete Seeger.
And indeed, years later, I met Pete Seeger in India, in Ballygunj, some one of these sort of weird quarters of Calcutta. And there's Pete Seeger. And I thought, that's not just some guy. That's my friend Pete Seeger. It was very strange to see him out of context, but not really out of context, since he was my first link to this belief that the people of foreign lands were not foreign, that we were all brothers. Sabako Sajana, all good people, he's the god of. So Pete Seeger was in many ways my entree to Hinduism. My mother then gave me a copy of A Passage to India, and I read it and I loved it. And I remember reading it in the middle of the night and the smell of the Long Island Sound and the foghorns, and I loved it.
There are some exquisite echoes in India. There's the whisper around the dome at Bijapur. There are the long, solid sentences that voyage through the air at Mandu and return unbroken to their creator. The echo in a Marabar cave is not like these. It is entirely devoid of distinction. Whatever is said, the same monotonous noise replies and quivers up and down the walls until it is absorbed into the roof. Boom is the sound as far as the human alphabet can express it. Or boom, or oh boom. Utterly dull. Hope, lightness, the blowing of a nose, the squeak of a boot, all produce boom. And if several people talk at once, an overlapping howling noise begins. Echoes generate echoes, and the cave is stuffed with a snake composed of small snakes which writhe independently. Suddenly, at the edge of Mrs. Moore's mind, religion appeared. Poor little talkative Christianity. And she knew that all its divine words, from let there be light to it is finished, only amounted to boom.
I discovered that the whole culture suited me, that I liked Indian food better than any other food, Indian music better than Western music, Indian saris better than the clothing that women wore in the West, and particularly I loved Indian religion and Indian literature better than the Western stuff.
At the end of most Hindu stories, there is a promise. For example, if the tale is about childhood, it says whoever hears this will have healthy children. If the story is about money, the hearer will get rich.
the story itself is a real experience. It's not something which then makes you go and do something as a result of hearing it. Hearing it transforms you. The act of hearing the story is an act, like lighting a candle or saying a prayer or something. It doesn't simply tell you how to get salvation. It is salvation. A man who was really bad. He was a liar and a thief. He was a murderer. He slept with an untouchable woman. He murdered his father and mother to get money to buy clothes for this untouchable woman that he was living with. He produced abortions. He was really, from the Hindu standpoint, a really terrible sinner. And one day, when he was unable to pay his gambling debts or something, he decided to rob a temple. So he went to a Shiva temple where they were reciting the Shiva Purana.
Dhanya Shiva Puranasya Katham Paramapavini Yasyaha Shravana.
While they were reciting the Shiva Purana, he robbed the temple and got the money and paid his pimp or paid his bookie or whatever it was and went on living for a long time. And then he died of syphilis, one assumes, or something. And the minions of the god of the dead came galloping up with sharpening their instruments of torture, ready to drag him down to hell and torture him for millions and millions of years. And as they were about to drag him away, Shiva's servants came and said, "Don't touch a hair of that man's head. He's coming to heaven to live forever in bliss with Shiva." And the servants of the god of hell said, "Are you kidding? There's been some little mistake here. Do you know who this guy is? What he's done? He's going to go to hell." And the Shiva's servant said, "Oh, yes, we know who he is, but he also once listened to a recitation of the Shiva Purana, and so he's going to live in heaven with Shiva forever and ever."
Matri Pitri Vadhuhanta Vaishagami Cha Madhyapaha Devarajo Dvitastatra Gatva Mukto.
What do you make of it?
It's a story of grace, of course. It's a story about storytelling. You see, the way a Christian would tell that story is he goes to the temple to rob it, and he hears the Shiva Purana. And the Shiva Purana is saying, "Don't rob, don't kill." And he'll say, "As a result of hearing the Shiva Purana, I have to become a good person." And he restores everybody and spends his life giving to the poor and everything like that. But that's not the way the Hindu tells the story. Just hearing the story was enough. It's like being given penicillin when you have syphilis. You can go on just living your whatever the life it's been. You can just keep taking penicillin, and you don't die of syphilis anymore. It's a cure. It's a foolproof cure, the hearing of a good story. I love the story. It's a special story, and I think a lot of Hindus would object to it.
Why?
Because most Hindus believe you have to be good, too. This is not a socially useful doctrine to spread around.
But you like the idea.
I love it. I love it. But I'm not a Hindu.
Wendy Doniger is not a Hindu. She is also not a left-wing politico, as her father was. Nor is she a communist atheist, which her mother remains to this day. She is a scholar, a student, and teacher of religion and the mythic stories that are the expression of religious belief. This outcome is somewhat bemusing to Wendy's mother.
Given that you think that myths are very silly stories that have no relevance to the truth.
That's right.
What do you think of the fact that I have spent the last 25 years writing books about myths?
You just liked it. Also, you were very bright, very brilliant, but I think it's all made up in your mind. A creation, but it has nothing to do with truth, with reality. No, no. But it's fun, and you enjoyed it, and people believe you.
Wendy's father died when she was 24. She felt his loss profoundly.
He was an intellectual, so he read everything I wrote. He was my father. He loved me. And I had no mythology to deal with it. I hadn't been raised as a serious Jew. There was no funeral for my father. My mother cremated him. When I came home sometime later and hung my coat in the coat closet, there was a box. And I said, "Oh, what's that?" And she said, "Oh, that's Daddy."
But by that time, although she was no Hindu, she was steeped in Indian myth and writing a book about the origins of death and evil in Hindu narrative. The god Shiva was on her mind and in her work. Shiva is a god who contains all opposites within himself. He combines the moon of fertility with the flame of destruction, the peace of pure contemplation with the desperate striving of the living world. Shiva is the cosmic dancer.
There's a wonderful myth of a sage
who was doing great asceticism for years and years and years, and finally one day he became so powerful in his yoga that he cut himself on a piece of holy grass. And out of the wound, vegetable sap flowed instead of blood. This was a great miracle, and he danced because he was so proud of himself. But his dancing was so violent that the world was threatened, and the gods went to Shiva and said, "You have got to stop this guy from dancing." So Shiva went up to him and said, "What's all this about?" And the guy said, "Look, Shiva, look. I cut myself and vegetable sap is coming out of my hand. That's why I'm dancing." And Shiva said, "That's nothing. Watch this." And Shiva took his thumbnail and cut his own hand. And out of the wound, instead of blood, ashes, white ashes flowed. The ashes of corpses that had been cremated. And the sage stopped dancing.
The Hindus believe that there are lots and lots of gods, and some love you and some don't love you, and that it's a good thing to have the world that way, that the world wouldn't be rich and full if there was just one guy up there who loved you, and that there are various divine forces at play, and there are lots of plans. There's not just one neat little plan, and that they all make sense, and that they all have to happen, and that there is a beauty and power in all of them. And some of them are pretty terrible.
Shiva dances. He dances both kinds of dances. He dances his beautiful dance, which is the dance of life, the dance that sets the universe in motion. His arms and his legs whirling around are the stars and the moon. But then he dances the doomsday dance, and he pounds the universe into flame and destruction. That's dancing, too. Most of the great myths I know are indeed about change and movement.
Hindus have a special affection for another dancing god, Krishna, an incarnation of the great world dreamer, who is depicted as a beautiful dark-skinned boy playing a flute. Krishna, as the story goes, was raised by an earthly mother, Yashoda. Being a god, a boy, and a mischief maker, Krishna leads Yashoda a merry chase.
Nachat Krishna Nachavat Gopi Nachat Krishna Nachavat Gopi.
Sometimes he enchants her, as this lullaby recounts. It's a story of how some neighborhood milkmaids and his mother were captivated by the movement of Krishna's hands and the beauty of his gestures. In the mythology of this culture, where the worlds of the mundane and the divine commingle, Krishna often plays tricks on his mortal mother, casting a spell over her memory, so that she forgets that he is a god.
One fine day, when the village children were playing, they ran up to Yashoda and told her, "Krishna is eating dirt again." Yashoda then took Krishna by the hand and said, "You are such a naughty boy. Why are you eating dirt?" "I haven't," said the god, who had playfully taken on the form of a human child. "And if you believe them more than you believe me, just look in my mouth yourself." "All right, Krishna," his mother said. "Open up." When Yashoda looked inside Krishna's mouth, she saw the whole universe, with the farthest reaches of the sky and the moon and the stars and the galaxies beyond. She also saw the earth whirling through space and space itself. She beheld thunder and lightning and great mountains and the sea. Then she saw her village and herself in the village, looking down the mouth, inside the mouth. Yashoda became frightened and confused, wondering, "Is all this a dream or an illusion made by God? Because God gives me other illusions such as, I exist. This is my husband. This is my son. What is real and what is illusion?" And then she fainted away. God then took compassion on her and wove a web of illusion for her. And this web was made of maternal love. Instantly, Yashoda lost all memory of what she had seen. She lifted her beloved son onto her lap and was as she had been before. But her heart was flooded with an even greater love for God, whom she took to be her own little boy, Krishna.
There's just a lot of things in that story. One thing is the Hindu view of the love of God and the different ways you can love God. You can love him as a woman loves her lover, as a slave loves a master, as a brother loves a brother, and most of all, best of all, you can love him as a mother loves a child. It's called calf love in Sanskrit, vatsalya, the love that a cow feels for a calf. I used to find it very difficult as an adolescent to think about the stars and about how small the planet Earth was and the galaxy and all that. You couldn't do that for long because you really cared about whether you're going to have pizza that night and whether you're going to have pepperoni on an Italian sausage. And at the same time, you knew that there were all these galaxies. And that's what that dream is about, that myth. The myth is what balances simultaneously the knowledge that you're part of the mind of God and therefore nothing you do is real, and the knowledge that to eat a really ripe mango is a great thing. When you switch registers from the telescope to the microscope, from the little tiny petty world, at any point, one world will call the other one into question. And you say, it's an illusion that I'm seeing God, or yes, you say, it's an illusion that I'm living my life and ordering a pizza. And there is no way, ultimately, of deciding which is the truth.
One of the things that makes myths universal is that they happen to everybody. They don't just happen to Greek heroes.
On the one hand, a Hindu myth was composed out of the life of some Hindu who was really different from me, ate different food, had a different body and everything. And some of the traces, the smells of his life are in that myth. The way the Hindus say you leave the perfume of a rebirth, the odor, the almost imperceptible traces of memory, which are called vasanas in Sanskrit. And when that myth moves me, it moves me because the smells of his life in it trigger my recollection of the smells of my life. It's your own life that you see. It's your own forgotten taste and perfumes which are triggered by a really well-told and deeply conceived myth. It combines the point of a philosophical dogma or abstract idea with the vividness of one's own dream and the detail. It goes between the two of them. I was alone and living on the west coast of Ireland in a little village writing my book about dreams and illusion. And I was on the coast and I went down to the beach and then look out to sea and see the outlines of the Aran Islands. A very peaceful and very beautiful place. And I saw a woman with beautiful Irish children. Irish children are so beautiful. And they were very happy and they were at their best, as children often are at the beach. And I'd always wanted to have more than one child, and at that moment I was envious. And I thought, what a shame. She has these wonderful children, and I always wanted to have more children, and I envied her. She had something that I wanted and didn't have. And then I suddenly was thinking a thought which I had read about in some ways, but which I guess I had not internalized, I hadn't accepted, that the whole human race is sort of interlocked in the ways that the Hindus believe. That woman was me in a way, and that she had my children for me, had saved me all the trouble of, you know, the childbirth and the diapers and everything, and that I didn't need to have any more children because she had hers, and there they were for me to look at on the beach, and that I had written books for her, perhaps. And that was a very comforting thought, and it stayed with me.
You see, that was sort of a Hindu way of looking at things.
That was a very Hindu way of looking at things, yes. The theory that Hindus have of society, that people don't exist as individuals at all, really, that who you are to other people defines you, that you are all interlocked in some very important ways. And that's a basic understanding of all Hindus from their childhood on.
One day, Kama, the god of erotic love, shot a flaming arrow of lust straight for the heart of Shiva, god of yogis, as he sat in meditation. Shiva then opened his vertical third eye and released from it the angry fire of asceticism intended to reduce this Kama to an ash. These fires of deepest lust and yogic fury met together in the air and combined to make a new fire that threatened to engulf the world. Wishing to prevent this, Brahma, the creator, paralyzed the strange new flame and placed it inside the mouth of a horse, a beautiful mare, whom he then put on the ocean floor to roam till doomsday. The ocean stops the mare fire from engulfing the worlds, and the mare fire keeps the ocean from flooding its banks. But at the end of time, Brahma will take this mare from the sea. The flames of her mouth will scorch the universe. Floods will follow. And the original, black, shoreless seas of creation will be restored.
So this is your great mythical beast, huh?
This is the mythical beast, the real mythical beast, most beautiful horse in the world. Want a carrot? Horses were important to me as myths before they were important as realities. Culture and nature, taming, sex, almost everything you can talk about is in horses. The whole world mythology of horses is connected. To the extent that India is part of the Indo-European world, the horse is very important. The magic animal that lures the king away from the palace into another world. Sometimes he's riding a horse and the horse bolts and he can't stop it, and when he finally comes to himself, he's lost. That's the Indo-European theme. Initiation into a world of exile, magic, testing, adventure, and the horse brings him into it. So I know mostly about Indian horses, but I also know about horses' horses. Now, I'm going to lead him out and put him over here. Do you know which end of the horse not to get near?
The back end.
That's it.
For Wendy, horses inhabit another world, somewhere between the foreign and the familiar, the wild and the tame.
You sort of tame a horse, but it's always a hair-trigger thing. You always end up falling off. The horse always ends up at some point in its life not doing what you expect it to do. There's always a wildness, especially in a good horse. Anytime I ride a horse, I cease to exist solely in the world of a lady professor. I imagine, at least, this is my mythology, that I become the centaur. I become part of the horse. He pulls me with him, not just into the physical forest, but into the world of animal reactions, animal emotions, going out into the forest and hearing the birds and seeing the deer, and the turtle laying its eggs, and he brings me as far as I can go from the world of the tame to the world of the wild. And that's what the centaur is, the half-wild, half-tame human being. I've always wanted to get run away with. I like to ride with as little reins as possible. I like the horse to express what he wants to do. I've always wanted to get run away with.
People who believe in myths have mythical things happen to them, Wendy has told me.
If you have read the myth, or many myths, then when you perceive your life, you perceive that it's a myth,
And even more than that, perhaps you're more likely to let your horse run away with you. So it's not just that you recognize it when it happens, but that you encourage it to happen. You'll look into the mouth of your child because you've read the myth of Yashoda, and then saying, I don't know what it is that is going to happen. I'm going into this cave even though I don't know what's in it. I'm going to ride this horse even though I don't know where he's going to take me. When you allow that you're in a myth and you don't know what the end of the story is, that's what's called having an adventure. God gets caught up in his own story. He starts telling the story, and then he starts caring about it, and he forgets that he made it.
What kind of a universe can you expect will follow from a God that gets caught up and lost in his own imaginings?
This universe. You're in it. We are in a universe created by a God who got caught up in his own imaginings. It's a universe that has television and Africa and giraffes and galaxies and all of that.
Pizza.
Pizza. Yeah.